WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Walter Kern writes, "When you can see things others can't, children in the womb, the hand of God, they call you a fanatic, but you know better what you are, a person with a vision." That's from Kern's new novel, She Needed Me. It's written from the point of view of a young man who has joined a cult-like anti-abortion group called the Conscience Squad. He falls in love with a woman he's trying to prevent from having an abortion. Kern describes this as a novel about religion and redemption. And he writes about religion in all of its most unusual contemporary manifestations, including cable TV shows and Christian cosmetics companies that sell door-to-door. Kern grew up in a Mormon family in a Lutheran town in Minnesota. She Needed Me is his first novel. He writes for many magazines and is a media critic for Mirabella. Before we talk with Kern, here he is reading from the opening of his novel.
As members of the Conscience Squad, we kept ourselves in a constant state of readiness, sleeping lightly, shoes beside our beds. We never knew when the call would come. A few of us, myself included, had lost good jobs because of this, not even having time to call in sick as we hustled into our clothes and out the door. On mornings when the school bus came, minutes mattered, excuses could wait. Lucas would honk the horn once, that's all. A second honk could rouse the neighbors, any of whom might warn the other side. If a person wanted breakfast, the school bus carried tea and donuts. Sometimes, on long trips, Lucas stopped at Burger King and ordered us malts and whoppers. Myself, I was usually too wound up to eat. My job was distributing the literature, snipping the twine on the heavy bales of pamphlets and passing them around to members before we reached the Target clinic. The slicker handouts, the ones with color photos showing the disturbing, bloody truth of what our opponents called the procedure, were obtained from a national clearinghouse in Georgia. The tracts that were made up of Bible verses and quotes from remorseful abortionists we produced ourselves. For its boldness and disciplined organization, the Conscience Squad had received citations from public figures too numerous to name, including a Catholic archbishop and a U.S. senator. It was the first group I had been a part of that actually stood for something, some idea. There were rumors that even the governor supported us, although his advisors would not let him say so for fear of offending liberal special interests. I was very proud to be a member.
Walter Kern, the main character in your novel is Weaver Walquist, and I wonder if he's somebody who you think you might have become at some point?
I think he was someone I was briefly, and someone my brother was. I grew up a Mormon, and like Weaver, I had a very set idea as a teenager about what was right and wrong. You know, it's amazing how young people can be more judgmental than any other age group. And I was a very young, rigid, Republican, religious type at one time.
Was there something you really wanted to understand by writing this book?
Yeah, there was. I, first of all, in writing about a member of the so-called religious right, wanted to understand a group which I think is barely described in any of our popular culture. And I wanted to understand what its appeal had been to me personally, because I was an eager beaver as a Mormon. I was ready to convert the world, and I wanted to understand how I got into it and how I got out of it, because I did get out of it. If anything, I'm a member of the media elite now rather than a Mormon, which is a strange transformation.
Your parents are Mormons?
We were converted. There's a story in my first book which is oddly biographical in that it seems too strange for reality, but Mormons came to the door one day, knocked, my father let them in, and they virtually took over our lives with our permission. We were in a fairly screwed up familial situation, and they solved our problems for us and made us members of their church, and you know, I don't know whether or not I look back on it fondly or not. I just remember it as an amazing transformation.
How old were you?
12, 13 years old.
What were the big problems in the family, and what did the Mormon Church do to change them?
Well, we use the word dysfunctional now, and I suppose that every behavior we put under the heading of dysfunctional, my family was suffering from. You know, there was drinking, there was fighting between the parents, there was fighting between the kids, and all of a sudden it was as though the angel of God came down to bring peace to us. As these religious people can do, they really have the ability to change people's lives, at least briefly, and that's why they're so successful.
So as a young Mormon boy, what did you do to be active in the church? What was new in your life?
Oh, you have to become literate in a whole new tradition, especially if you've come from a sort of secular, unreligious background. You start reading the Bible, you start entering contests concerning your knowledge of the Bible, you start regulating your behavior in a new way, your sexual behavior. For example, as a teenager, there were a lot of strictures on my behavior, which I happily agreed and went along with. And going to be in a group every weekend, I think that was the biggest change. You know, Americans are more and more not in groups and do everything by themselves at home. And suddenly we were going to sit in a room every week with hundreds of people, and not just once a week, but several times a week. And they were my family, I was told. And I hadn't had a family that big before, and I can tell you it was an interesting and refreshing change from the sort of isolation of the suburban nuclear family into this great ecstatic group of people. Oh boy, I didn't even want to watch television.
Now, in the area where you grew up in Minnesota, I think it was predominantly Lutheran?
Yeah.
So were you considered kind of freakish being Mormon in a predominantly Lutheran area?
Well, we were converted during a brief stay in Phoenix, Arizona, and we came back with our Mormonism on our back. It's a kind of a Western, more than a Midwestern religion, and we continued to practice it in Minnesota, but it was strange. Whereas the Mormons had been a majority in a way, or at least a huge group in Phoenix, they were a tiny, struggling minority in Minnesota, and it was never quite the same once we moved back. That sense of being connected to everyone went away, and I felt like we were a group of freaks, misunderstood, disliked.
You were 12 when your family was converted to and became Mormons. So just about the point that you were going through puberty, your family becomes very religious.
At precisely the point. Sometimes I think it was a conspiracy to prevent me from using my newfound hormones.
Well, you have a story in your first book, a collection of short stories called My Hard Bargain. And the first story in there, called Planetarium, is a story about a young man who's just going through puberty, and he stimulates himself a lot, and he knows from the sermons in church that this is a he knows from the bishop that this is very bad, and he confesses to it, and he's shocked to find out that he knows the exact number of times he's done it, because he can mention that precisely to the bishop. But the bishop tells him, and tells all the boys, to kind of keep track of how many times they stimulate themselves, and to write an X in invisible ink that can only be seen in ultraviolet light. And at the end of the story, he puts up everybody's X's and turns on the ultraviolet light, and the whole, the whole like ceiling is lit up with X's. And I guess reading that, I just couldn't help but wonder if you were asked to do anything like that ever.
What I was asked to do in real life to end my habit of self-stimulation was much more gruesome than that story records. A Mormon bishop told me, he asked me if I did this. I said yes. And he said, well, do you imagine a beautiful woman while you're stimulating yourself? And I said, in fact, I do. And he said, well, I want you to imagine her differently. I want you to imagine that she has a terrible wound and is bleeding. And every time you see that, you'll want to stop stimulating yourself. And I went back and was stupid enough to actually try this program. I have no idea what harm it's caused me since.
That's really strange.
It's truly strange. I mean, the strangest things happen in the plainest boxes, Mormon churches and Midwestern small towns. That's been my experience. The cities are hives of conformism compared to the bizarre outgrowths of behavior that happen in the Midwest.
Yeah, well, let me quote something from your book, the town that the main character comes from. He says, underneath the small town, there were secret passageways with doors that opened on strange, illicit places.
Small towns are like stage sets, and I speak from experience. I live in one now, and I grew up in them. And they're all about putting out appearances to the neighbors. And once that's done, all heck breaks loose behind the closed doors. And I remember in the town I grew up in, Minnesota, there was illegal gambling. There were more drugs than I've ever seen since. There was sex, sometimes incest, practiced quite openly. You know, out west you have polygamous communities. Not many people know about them, but there are quite a few. Small town life is like opening a trap door and getting down in the root cellar. Strange things happen down there.
What were the sins that you were most afraid of as you were coming of age in a new religion?
Every single one of them, really. I mean, it was as though you were just surrounded by pits, and you could hardly take a step without falling into one of them. In the bishop's interview that they give you every month as a Mormon, they always ask you first, have you committed murder? Which seemed so strange to me as a 13-year-old that I could be suspected of murder. But I realized that I was suspected of absolutely everything just by virtue of being a sinful human being. And that's what's funny about religion, is it usually doesn't make much distinction between smoking a cigarette, which is illegal in Mormon theology, and committing murder. Just as it doesn't make a distinction between having an abortion and committing murder. It tends to get the trivial behaviors mixed up with the profound ones.
If you're just joining us, my guest is writer Walter Kern. He has a new novel called She Needed Me, and the novel is about a young man in an anti-abortion group called the Conscience Squad, who tries to talk a young woman out of an abortion, and they end up on the road together. We'll be back after a short break. This is Fresh Air. Walter Kern is my guest, author of the new novel, She Needed Me. In your novel, the young man who becomes a member of the Conscience Squad, the Right to Life group, before he becomes converted and before he becomes a member of this group, he was a pretty wild teenager, a lot of drugs and alcohol. He and his friends would take off and write 666 with spray paint on walls. And would write destruction with a K. And what else would they write? The beast be with us, Satan rises. So he goes from that into becoming a member of this group, the Conscience Squad. Did the opposite happen to you? Did you, after coming of age as a Mormon, then end up with spray paint writing the beast be with us?
I never wrote those words. They were my wilder friends who that character is based on. You know, small town Satanism does exist. I mean, it's cuckoo and it's kids imitating something they've heard about, but it's real. It's a strange attempt at protest that goes on in religious communities. Hey, the only rebel you've ever had portrayed to you is the devil. So when it's time to rebel, you use your idea of the devil to do it. And it's, you know, it's comic in a way, but it exists. It's out there.
Did you listen to heavy metal music?
Yeah, I listened to heavy metal music. I tried to hear the subtle hidden messages of urging me to suicide. I already knew that it was forbidden. I mean, you know, it's one of those forbidden fruits that takes on extra luster. And I loved heavy metal music. Most small town kids do, really, at some point in their life. It's all about ecstasy and breaking free and, you know, ruling the universe and dominating women if you're a man and everything you think you want at 16.
So the devil iconography really had this power.
Well, I think people underestimate the extent to which a lot of Americans see history still as this struggle between God and the devil. Just that literally. I know that, you know, there are whole groups of people who base their entire way of life on this thesis all over America, not just in the Midwest. We're not the progressive, shiny, secular society we sometimes think of ourselves once you scratch the surface.
So when you were listening to heavy metal music, were you still a Mormon or had you left the fold?
I think I was on my way out. I mean, but you have to be a Mormon to be interested in the devil. You have to be religious to be interested in the devil. And so I guess it was the transition point. But it's scary. I mean, heavy metal music listened to over headphones with your eyes closed while high on marijuana is a pretty harrowing experience. And in my book, the character just can't take it.
So when you left Minnesota,
yeah,
and went to Princeton to go to college, how did your life change?
It was probably, it was both liberating and excruciatingly alienating to go from Schaefer, Minnesota, population 500, to Princeton University, home of the, I don't know, the elite, really. That's, everyone seemed smarter, better dressed, more beautiful, as though they knew where the levers were that operated the world, and I had no clue. I was watching, I felt like a guest at a country club. I felt like I had a day pass at a country club, and the security guard would come make me leave.
Can you be close to your parents after you've left the religion that they're still in?
As a matter of fact, my parents left the religion before I did. It was fun for me. I stayed in it because it was a wonderful group of young people, people to hang out with, people to listen to heavy metal music at night with. My parents, who had joined the church to sort of, I think, heal a very painful time in their lives, once that was healed, were no longer interested. A lot of people drift in and out of religion, be it New Age or, you know, more traditional.
Well, I'm trying to think of how confused they must have been. If they left the church and you stayed in it, but while you were in it, you were listening to heavy metal music about the devil with a lot of other Mormon teenagers. I mean, it's
that was our night side.
Uh-huh.
During the day, we wore white shirts.
Uh-huh.
It's hard to explain how complex life gets when you supercharge it with good and evil, which is, and think about good and evil all the time. You know, you just end up living a topsy-turvy life.
So how did you actually finally split from the church?
I realized that it was, in Mormonism, it's mandatory pretty much that at 18, a young man go on a mission for 2 years, spread the gospel. I wanted an education. I wanted to be a writer by that time. And they gave me a choice, and I took the education.
They gave you a choice of...
Between going on a mission and going to Princeton, basically.
Oh, and that would have been acceptable within the religion? Or did going to Princeton mean that you were leaving?
Going to Princeton, most Mormons at 18 go off and become missionaries for 2 years and then go to college. I wanted to go to college as soon as I possibly could.
So that decision meant you were out?
Basically.
When you left the Mormons, which is a very disciplined group, did you feel a void in your life? Okay, you found education, you were at Princeton, but suddenly this like structure wasn't there anymore. Did you look for that in something else?
I looked for it in writing, really, and studying. Luckily, being a Mormon had taught me to study. You got up at 6 in the morning to read the Book of Mormon in the Bible. That's a very good habit to get into if you want to be a writer. I've kept many of the same habits I had. I've changed my beliefs somewhat. And there was no real void. I mean, the figures of literature were at least as inspiring to me as the Mormon saints.
I'm tempted to ask you your impression of New Age groups and the function that you think they're playing in contemporary culture, because you touch on that in your novel too. And as the main character, he once tries something called ergonics and Aquarian rebirth, and he says he wanted to be in the place where everyone looked like movie stars without having movie stars' problems.
Well, that's what the New Age seems to promise, as far as I can tell. I'm no authority on it. What I do know is that a lot of people go back and forth between the New Age and more traditional Christianity. This is not two separate groups of people. There is one great group of seekers in American life, and they shop at all the markets. The New Age is one of the religious markets. It strikes me as not being new in any way. As far as I know, since the founding of America, think positive, grow rich has been the underlying philosophy of the majority.
Do you feel that there's anything in your writing that you are in the middle of working through right now?
I'm at one of those odd, vulnerable times for a writer when my life and work totally confused. My relationships with women are totally confused, which is probably why I want to write about polygamy. An old-fashioned solution to a very modern problem, which is our inability to stay with one person exclusively. And I pretty nakedly try to work out my own problems in my books. You know, you don't get paid enough to write books to make it worthwhile for any other reason except as a kind of therapy.
Walter Kern, I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
Okay, thanks.
Walter Kern's new novel is called She Needed Me. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.